This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Eek. Last year, Singapore's first brain bank was launched by Nanyang Technological University Singapore's Lee Kong Chian School of Medicine, done in partnership with the National Healthcare Group and the National Neuroscience Institute. The brain bank aims to be a resource for research into neurological disorders. So to help us find out more about how Brain Bank Singapore will function and the research involved, we're speaking now to its director, Professor Richard Reynolds. Good afternoon, Prof. Richard. How are you today?
Good afternoon. I'm well. Thank you very much.
Prof. Richard, could you first explain to us what is a brain bank?
Well, a brain bank is a facility that is in either a hospital or a university that collects brain tissues from people after they die, brings them back to the facility and prepares them and stores them, and then hands them out to researchers for vital research into neurological disorders of all types. So it really is a bank that brings the tissue in and then sends the tissue out to researchers.
Okay. And judging by the name, obviously it's brain tissue we're talking about.
Yes, it's brain tissue, but it really does include the spinal cord as well. Because the spinal cord is affected in many brain disorders. And we also collect samples of the fluid that surrounds the brain and spinal cord, because that can be useful to develop new markers of disease, for example.
All right. Could you give us some background to how the Brain Bank Singapore came about?
Yes, it came about partly from discussions that took place in a task force set up by the Ministry of Health here in Singapore about 3 or 4 years ago. And researchers were asked about their priorities for future facilities for research. And one of the things that they highlighted was the need for a brain tissue bank in Singapore. I had been running a brain bank in London, the UK, for 20 years and started to have discussions with them about setting one up here in Singapore. The Lee Kong Chian School of Medicine is a joint medical school with Imperial College in London. Therefore, I was involved with them already. And researchers in working on neurological disorders in Singapore really do need access to human tissues for research, because some of the questions that you need to ask can only be asked by studying the human brain. You can't study cells in a dish or animals. You need to study the real human brain. And as you know, you can only study the human brain in a living person by imaging with magnetic imaging machines. But yes, you don't get much detail from that. You don't get detail of what are the molecules that are damaging the brain in these disorders. So you have to study human tissues. So that was the background to how it was set up, because there was no such facility in this part of the world at the time that they could access tissue from.
You know, if we look at epidemiological trends of neurological disorders and diseases, has there been a shift in this in these trends indicating an urgent need to, you know, amp up research in this area?
Yes, I think there has actually. Although we have treatments for some disorders that affect the brain, we certainly don't have good treatments for the major ones, such as Alzheimer's disease and other dementias and Parkinson's disease. And there's a growing community, of course, of elderly people who are experiencing disorders of the brain due to increased longevity now in our society. So we do have an increase in these conditions. And the second reason is that now we understand that the way in which each individual responds to a brain disorder and also responds to a treatment is different, that we need to think more about individual treatments. And that has come to light because only recently have we been able to understand the genetic background. Of every person is different, and it determines the way in which they respond to a disease process. And that information is really only just been available in the last couple of years, which means we now need to study brain tissue and brain disorders in light of the genetic background of the, you know, community.
So with the brain tissue that you would have access to in the brain bank, researchers would need a huge volume, wouldn't they, in order to be able to look at the diversity?
Yes, this is one of the problems. And worldwide, there's probably a shortage of brain tissues for research, not just in this part of the world. Individual researchers, if they just happened to be able to collect brains within their own institution or hospital, just wouldn't have access to enough brains. Mm-hmm. So you do need to have a much larger collection of them to be able to make sense of what is causing the damage in the brain and how to identify drug targets against that. And you can only do it with a large facility, really, now. Mm-hmm. That's even more important now that we know that genetic background plays a big role, that we need to increase the numbers, because the differences between genes in all the populations is so great that we need to encompass that in studies in some way.
What would be some of the differences in how, say, Caucasian and Asian brains are and how they are differently affected by neurological disorders?
So this information is really only just coming to light, and only in this last 12 months has a study been published about the genetic background of Parkinson's disease, for example, in Asian populations versus Caucasian populations. So we're only just beginning to learn what those differences are. The best example I could tell you about is probably a condition that I work on called multiple sclerosis, which is a condition of young adults in the brain. And in white Caucasian populations, it is more common in women, about 2 to 3 to 1 compared to men. And it affects predominantly the brain, with some damage in the spinal cord. In Asian populations, for example, Japan, it's as common in men as it is in women. And it affects more the spinal cord than the brain. But it does appear to be the same condition. So I think the genetic makeup can play quite an important role in how the disease develops and what damage is caused in the brain. I think we're only just beginning to learn about the effects in other conditions, such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. But my colleagues in the National Neuroscience Institute tell me that there are some differences in Parkinson's disease as well, which will be important for treatment effects.
And, you know, in the absence of this kind of disaggregated information, how has it disadvantaged, you know, different populations where perhaps less information is known about how the neurological disorders affect them?
I guess the main way, although we don't have all this information yet, the main way is probably that treatments may not be optimal in one population versus another. If all the studies are done looking at disease processes in white European brains, for example, and drug targets are identified on the basis of that research, I mean, there's a possibility that those drugs will not be as effective with a very different genetic background.
But we don't know that for sure, epidemiologically?
We don't yet, no. We're assuming that would be the case. We don't have good treatments yet for Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease, of course, apart from treatments for the symptoms. We don't have treatments to stop the disorders. But research in other conditions is suggesting that this might be the case. And we certainly know that not everyone responds to effective therapies anyway. They're never totally effective. And the most likely cause of that is that because our genetic backgrounds are all different.
I see, yeah. And is the Brain Bank Singapore the first of its kind in the Southeast Asian region?
It's the first of its kind, yes, in the more closely defined Southeast Asian region. There is a brain bank in China. I'm not aware that much tissue comes out of China that's available to other countries wanting to use it.
Right.
We don't know much about it, to be honest.
I see.
There's a brain bank in India, but again, that's a very different genetic population to Southeast Asia. And again, I don't know whether it's of the size that would be able to supply tissue more widely.
Mm. But picking up on that, you know, even, say, within Singapore, you have a very diverse ethnic population. You, again, need representative sampling across all the ethnicities, wouldn't you?
Yes, that is indeed very true. We would. And that is the plan. We're certainly talking to all the different ethnic communities about the importance of this scheme we've set up to become a brain donor.
Mm-hmm. And what would be the main research areas when you get started?
Well, the Brain Bank itself doesn't do research. The Brain Bank itself is the facility that arranges for the brains to come in and to store them and to send them out.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the research going on amongst many colleagues I know of in Singapore are studying disease mechanisms in Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, mm-hmm. Some on multiple sclerosis, recovery from stroke, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we intend to collect brains from people who've died who have suffered from depression and schizophrenia as well. So it's understanding the processes that go on in those brains. So, yes, we don't do research ourselves
course,
as such,
yes.
But there's a very, very large internationally renowned neuroscience community in Singapore, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really big hub of research on brain disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And they have all mentioned that they require access to these human tissues. So I think they will be going out to a large number of research groups just in Singapore, but then in other places around the world as well, if we can supply to others, we are set up to do that.
All right. And of course, it looks like neurological disorders in general, you're talking degenerative, stroke, mental health. How is that different from, you know, when you were in the UK, you were involved with the a more specialized tissue bank, multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's disease tissue banks. So, I mean, what would be the disadvantages of focusing broadly?
I don't think there are any disadvantages. I think it's just about population size here.
Mm-hmm.
So in the United Kingdom, the population is much bigger and there are specialized tissue banks for studying multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's. There are about five different Alzheimer's disease tissue banks in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Singapore, with a smaller population, it makes sense to put them all into one national bank.
Mm.
Simply in the UK, we didn't have to do that. And we were funded by a specific charity that funds research in a particular neurological condition. And therefore, it was set up as an individual tissue bank. So there's no disadvantages at all. It's just about numbers. You know, it makes sense to pull it all into one national facility.
All right. I'm speaking to Professor Richard Reynolds, the director of the Brain Bank Singapore. We're talking about the why the Brain Bank has been set up in Singapore. What kind of research will it facilitate with the brain and spinal cord tissue that it stores? And when we come back, Prof. Richard, let's talk a little bit about how the Brain Bank would work. Who are you reaching out to donors? And sort of trying to overcome perhaps some challenges in getting donors to contribute, well, to donate brain tissue, I suppose, and how all of that would actually look like logistically. So you're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiaoyik. I'm speaking to Professor Richard Reynolds, Director of Brain Bank Singapore, who's joining me on Skype. The Brain Bank was launched by the Nanyang Technological University Singapore's Lee Kong Chian School of Medicine last year in partnership with the National Healthcare Group and the National Neuroscience Institute. It aims to be a resource for research into neurological disorders, you know, degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. We're also talking about things like multiple sclerosis, stroke, the brain and spinal cord tissue that's collected and stored in this bank will be used by researchers to look at how these diseases develop, how they affect individual brain tissue, and hopefully be able to be applied for clinical practice. Prof. Reynolds, perhaps let's look at how the Brain Bank would actually work. Who are you looking to for donors?
Okay, so the first task that we are engaged in is to recruit donors onto a prospective donor scheme. So we're engaging in quite a large set of educational events to talk to people about why research needs human tissue, human brain tissue in particular, and how people can help by giving consent to become a donor when they pass away. Mm-hmm. So we're actually spending a lot of time doing this. We're arranging meetings within neurological clinics around Singapore, within patient interest groups where patients get, and their families get together to talk about care for their loved ones, etc., with the conditions. And also public events in libraries, for example, in community gatherings, just to convince people that, that this is a really important issue, that some of the questions we're probably only going to be able to answer by studying human brain tissues. So that's the first thing that we're doing, running lots of different public events. The next thing that happens is that we have all the facilities set up now here to retrieve the brains and study the brains. So what happens when a person has given consent for their brain to be retrieved by us after they die? We are informed very quickly by the family or the treating healthcare workers, because they have a donor card, like a donor card for transplant, similar system, and an emergency phone number to call. And then we arrange for a funeral director to move the body to one place, which is at the National University of Singapore, where they have agreed to remove the brain and the spinal cord, if that is possible as well. And we will then quickly arrange to collect that brain tissue when it's being removed. The the body is given back to the funeral director, the casket company, to carry on with the normal family arrangements for a funeral. So it doesn't slow that down for very long at all, maybe 1 or 2 hours maximum. Then the brain is brought back in a fresh condition to our facility here, where it is dissected, so that we can study smaller pieces of the brain tissue. And then it is stored in various ways to preserve both the structure of the brain and also the molecules within the brain, so that they can be studied in greater detail. And then researchers contact us and tell us a bit about the research, the vital research that they require the tissue for, and then we will prepare it for shipping out to them. So that's the last stage of the process.
Right. And I think quite understandably, and this may be due to cultural factors as well, some people may have reservations about donating their brain tissue for research. What is that like in Singapore, and how do you plan to address that?
Yes, that is an issue anywhere, actually. I mean, we encountered that in the United Kingdom as well. There's reservations about donating organs for transplantation as well, and only slightly more reservation about donating tissue for research rather than for transplantation. And yes, there are some cultural differences, but we have encountered these before in the UK. It's really about education, I think, about telling people what a great need there is for this tissue, how important it is for future generations, maybe future generations of their family as well, that we're able to treat these devastating conditions that really have a big effect on the whole family and on society as a whole. So it's about talking these issues through. It's about helping people to understand what it means to be a brain donor and what happens to the brain afterwards, and how The family is still able to view the body if that is done in their particular culture, and it really doesn't slow down the whole process of funeral arrangements. So it's done in a very sensitive way to talk to people about all the issues that they would have reservations about. Mm-hmm. We are actually doing a number of surveys at the moment to see what those issues are in various communities.
Yes.
They're ongoing at the moment. We're doing an online survey at the moment from the university students, actually, because they're a population we can easily access to begin with, mm-hmm. just to test out our questionnaires. And then we will be trying to do a national survey to understand the cultural issues, reservations amongst people in Singapore.
Would you be engaging with specific communities through their community leaders, perhaps, or faith leaders?
Yes, indeed. Yes, we will definitely be doing that. We've started mm-hmm. to do that already.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly will be engaging with faith leaders as well. We've done some of that in the United Kingdom as well, and I think mm-hmm. that's a very important step.
Yeah.
We're aware of religious issues mm-hmm. As well that may bring reservations about donating tissues for research, and we need to address those and talk to people about them. One thing I'd like to say in that respect, as you know, having run a brain bank for 20 years mm-hmm. and having encountered these issues, mm-hmm. UK is very multinational society these days, is that one of the general things in society is that people want to help others,
mm.
no matter what their background, and even religious background as well. It's about helping your brother or sister.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're trying to do here. It's about stopping these devastating diseases for the next generation, basically.
Mm.
So everyone can play a part in that if they feel that they can do that.
So in Singapore, you have there are two laws pertaining to organ donations. There's one which is a mandatory one, which you have to opt out of. And then I think there's one that you can opt into for research. Am I right in assuming that donating brain tissue to the bank would come under the opt-in scheme?
Yes, that's right. Ours is an opt-in scheme. Mm. It's a specific scheme set up by us to donate brains for research, because there isn't a global one for doing that at the moment. It will work alongside the opt-out scheme for donating organs for research and bodies for medical education.
Mm-hmm.
And we're working with the government department that organised that, so that we will know whether someone has agreed to donate to either scheme.
Oh, I see. Okay. And what about the confidentiality of the donors? What are the safeguards to protect that?
The safeguards are that the confidential information is kept absolutely isolated on a computer that's not on the internet, that can only be accessed by the Brain Bank team. The data is all encrypted. It will be anonymized, pseudo-anonymized, so that there's only the director and the manager of the Brain Bank will be able to link personal information to identifiers about the brain. As soon as the brain goes out to researchers, they have no access at all to any personal information about that donor
mm-hmm.
That would allow them to identify them. So that all that information is kept 100% confidential to those operating the brain bank.
But the researchers would have information about the age of the deceased, ethnic background, those kinds of things?
Yes, it's very important for the research that we provide them with a summary of the clinical history
mm-hmm.
of the patient, because it allows them to get greater information from their studies of the brain tissue about how it has affected various aspects of their neurological function, etc. So we provide de-identified, it's called de-identified data on mm. on their medical background.
Mm.
And that's vital. That's one of the things, again, that Singapore does very well. It has very good records, digital records of all the patients, and that information will be summarized, basically, to go together with the brain tissue.
Okay. And you had mentioned earlier the neuroscience community, the research community in Singapore, who will, of course, be able to access this tissue. Will it be available to researchers in the region as well, for instance?
Yes, indeed. Yes. Mm. It is a plan to make the tissue available to anyone in the world, should they require it. But first, in the immediate region around Singapore. Mm. The law for this opt-in scheme says that we have to ask the donors if they're happy for tissue to go outside Singapore. And as long as they have ticked the box and agreed to that, that allows us to provide researchers in the greater region access to the tissues as well.
And are there plans to expand the volunteer pool, again, by looking to other countries in the region?
Now, this is something we'll have to explore. There are barriers to that, of course, in that the logistical barriers to start with, that we need to rapidly retrieve a brain very quickly, hopefully within 24 hours after death. Mm-hmm. That brings logistical problems if we're doing that outside of Singapore. Mm-hmm. But also then there's the fact that the legislation that governs the use of human tissues for research may be different from one country to another. And therefore we'd have to work within that local legislation. So it's not impossible, but it will have logistical issues. We'll have to look into and think about that in the future. It could be possible to have a satellite bank, for example, in Malaysia, mm-hmm. Where brains were collected locally from local donors, mm-hmm. that runs along identical lines to the one in Singapore, so that it harmonizes all the procedures. That is a possibility, and we have done that to overcome the geographical differences in the UK, for example. We have a satellite that helps us in the north of it. The UK. Mm-hmm. So that kind of arrangement would be possible in the future. Yeah.
Okay. What stage is the Brain Bank Singapore at right now?
We're at a very early stage. We don't have brains yet because this has been set up from right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So we're in the phase at the moment of signing up donors to the bank. We've been operating the donor scheme only since the launch at the end of November last year. Mm-hmm. And to date, we have 22 donors already signed up. Most of those donors signed up during about the first month and a half. But since the COVID-19 virus situation, mm-hmm. Everything has obviously slowed down because we're not allowed to hold educational meetings with the public now until this problem has been overcome. So donations have been a bit slow. But we estimate on the basis on those first few months of having about 20 people sign up per month over the whole year, we're estimating something in the region of 250 donors signing up per year. And over 4 years, that's about 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's an estimate. And we don't know exactly what the figures will be. But from my experience of running a brain bank for 20 years, if you have 1,000 donors, that's enough for at least 20 brains a year to come into the brain bank. Mm. But these are estimates because you can't possibly know exactly how that will work out.
Of course, yes. Do you have a final message, Prof. Richard?
Yes, my final message is that this is an important donor scheme that anyone at this moment in Singapore can become involved in to really help the community to understand neurological disorders and to help find new treatments for them so that they won't affect the future generations.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Professor Richard Reynolds, the director of the Brain Bank Singapore. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.